They've felt abandoned by the police. They've felt a level of indifference from this government that they I don't think they've ever seen before.
We get a street view of ongoing Hong Kong protests. It's Monday, July 29th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China uses high tech to contain Uyghurs, keeping terrorists out of Australia, coral reef stress, mapping tumor cells, and a tiny dinosaur terror. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Police in Hong Kong have appealed to people to stay indoors with their windows shut as officers use tear gas to try to drive protesters from the streets. Chaotic scenes filled several blocks in the western part of Hong Kong Island late Sunday as police pushed the protesters back and away from the Chinese government's liaison office and a police station. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Suzanne Settaline, who is covering the Hong Kong protests for VOA. She had been out with the protesters most of the day and late into Sunday and spoke about what led up to Sunday's happenings.
This started out as a response to the government's prohibition against a march. The government, for the last 2 days, declined to approve two marches. And the protesters went ahead and took part in these actions, even though they were illegal. Now, today there was approval for a rally in a park, and I guess that drew about, I think the protester, the organizer said 11,000 people. But it was clear from the get-go that people were going to stage a bigger action, people who didn't even go to the rally. And a lot of this stems from the anger over what happened a week ago in this. It's a residential slash industrial area that's to the north of Hong Kong near the border with mainland China. And there was a terrible scene of white t-shirted thugs beating people either on trains or on the stairs and in the concourse of a rail station. They knew the police were being slow to respond, but I don't think people realized how slow. And then the police admitted it took them 39 minutes to get there with a sizable enough contingent. And this made people here bananas. So they've felt abandoned by the police. They've felt inaction by the chief executive, Carrie Lam, indifference, a level of indifference from this government that I don't think they've ever seen before from an earlier administration.
So they had a whole week to have their anger built against the police and the government. So How did this weekend, especially Sunday night's demonstrations and protests, differ from those that preceded it?
This action that really centered on the western part of Hong Kong Island around what's called the China Liaison Office. This is Beijing's main representative here in Hong Kong. This was a lot of well-orchestrated action, pressing the police to try to get back down to the liaison office, holding a large roadway that they didn't cede for hours, despite many, many rounds of tear gas. And there was repeatedly these kind of older protesters would come back. And the last time I saw this man, he said to them, you know, once you get tear gassed, it's really not a big deal. The plan at one point was we're just going to keep marching west on this main thoroughfare. And I think the dream was that they were just going to keep marching through the tear gas. And then the cops just like started firing like crazy. I don't think they had any great idea what they're going to do when they got down to the liaison office, because after last week, when they threw paintballs at the building and at the national emblem of China. The government now has put, I think they call it the Mills barriers. They're very high barriers that they can fill with water, plastic barriers filled with water. And they've now nestled these or strung these around the perimeter of the liaison office. You can't really get to the liaison office. And they've put a plexiglass cover over the emblem so it can't be defiled again. And I think the idea was this: the people were going to mass in front of the liaison office again. And as one young man told me, liaison office runs Hong Kong now. It's very clear to everyone. She is, Carrie Lam, the chief executive, is taking all her cues from Beijing. She's not listening to the people. She's not really even listening to their other administrative departments of the government. She's certainly not listening to her civil servants. There's growing signs that civil servants are very angry with her, and they've staged very clever protests where they've posted their warrant cards, images of their, basically their IDs on Instagram, and posted them online just as a sign, like a silent protest against this administration. So, and then a big chunk of the legislature is with the opposition parties, so they don't agree with her. So she's lost a lot of support, and where she does get support is from Beijing. And so the kids thought, well, we'll go down and we'll protest outside of the liaison office again, because that's the power center. And so they've managed to hold this road for hours and endure multiple rounds of tear gas again and again and again.
When did this wrap up? On Sunday
night?
Yeah.
They made it hard for people to get out of there because they closed off three subway exits, so three subway stations. There was a lot of like running around trying to get back toward an area where there was subway service. For some people, it went on longer because they couldn't really get out of there.
Suzanne Sadeline talking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman via Skype from Hong Kong. Police arrested 13 people, including march organizer Max Chung, for offenses including unlawful assembly, possession of an offensive weapon, and assault, according to police and Hong Kong media. At least four officers were injured. The hospital authority said 24 people were taken to five hospitals. As of Sunday morning, eight remained hospitalized, two in serious condition. Amnesty International, the human rights group, called the police response heavy-handed and unacceptable. Police said they had to use what they termed appropriate force because of the bricks and other objects being thrown at them, including glass bottles with a suspected corrosive fluid inside. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find when you visit voanews.com right now, online, or on your mobile phone. Hong Kong police fired tear gas to disperse pro-democracy protesters. Myanmar holds repatriation talks with Rohingya refugees. South Koreans, Russians returned days after boat drifts to North Korea. Militants attack political office of ex-Afghan spy chief. Indonesia's president says sinking Jakarta needs giant seawall. Expanded coverage of all these stories and much more can be found daily on Facebook at VOA Asia. We invite you to also visit the voanews.com website. We continue now with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. China's government uses advanced technology to monitor and censor daily life of the people in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. That's according to Johur Ilham, daughter of prominent jailed Uyghur scholar and economist Ilham Todi. Her observation comes amid reports that the United States government is considering sanctions against Chinese video surveillance from Hikvision for its role in China's treatment of its Uyghur minority in the internment camps. State Department correspondent Nike Ching has more.
More than 1 million Muslim Uyghurs have been detained in camps. China says they are re-education centers, but critics say they are designed to erase the Uyghur identity and religious beliefs. Also, defenders of Uyghur rights, such as Yuhan Tokti, have been repressed. The prominent scholar has been serving a life sentence since 2014 after being accused by Chinese authorities of splitting the nation. But his daughter, Zhuhua Yuhan, says her father has never promoted violence or separatism. Fearing she may never hear from other family members for speaking out, Yuhan says everyday life in Xinjiang is under heavy surveillance.
A personal acquaintance of mine visited Uyghur region a year ago, and she said when she passed the checkpoint, she saw at least 8 images of her showing on the screen were in different locations of that city. This is absurd. There's no privacy at all.
The U.S. is considering tighter export controls on Chinese video surveillance company Hikvision over its alleged involvement in the Uyghur detention camps.
There are bills in Congress where people are putting forward ideas of various other entities as well, but there's been particular concerns thus far on Hikvision by the U.S. government.
Yuhan says she will support punitive measures against companies that facilitate the Uyghur detention camps to operate.
No matter food company, technology company, camera company, no matter what company it is, whether if it's a new one, a big one, a small one, as long as it's contributed for creating a larger concentration camp, then I don't support it to exist. I encourage U.S. to boycott them.
Beijing rejects accusations that it abuses religious rights.
We demand that the United States correctly views China's religious policies and the status of religious freedom in China and stop using the issue of religion to interfere in other countries.
U.S. President Donald Trump met recently with Yuhan and other victims of religious persecution at the White House. The U.S. is also pondering sanctions against Chinese officials over the treatment of the country's Uyghurs. Nike Chin, VOA News, State Department.
Happening now in Asia, a judge in Australia's Northern Territory has been accused of racism toward Indigenous defendants. Court transcripts published in the Australian media show Judge Greg Borchers accusing an Aboriginal woman of abandoning her children while drunk in, quote, that great Indigenous fashion. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us as we both begin our brand new week here on VOA Asia. New terror legislation to stop foreign fighters from returning to Australia has been approved by lawmakers. The government says the new laws will prevent carnage in Australia, but experts say the exclusion measures will apply mostly to women and children and will increase the risk of radicalization. We hear more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Australian government officials say the new law will give intelligence agencies time to manage the flow of foreign fighters back to Australia. It will allow the government to exclude an Australian citizen for up to 2 years if they're considered to be a security risk. It's estimated that 230 Australians travelled to Iraq and Syria to fight with militant groups. About 40 are thought to have returned home, raising fears that they've brought home not only a dangerous ideology, but combat skills. Government lawmaker Andrew Hastie said returning militants brought with them hard hearts and a proven capacity for violence and bloodshed. Australia says the new measures are similar to those in Britain. Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton says the laws will make Australia safer.
The government now is asking for the support of this Parliament to introduce legislation to temporarily exclude those people who we believe would come to our country to cause death and carnage in Australia.
The new laws to ban foreign fighters from returning to Australia will mostly apply to women and children, many of whom are held in refugee camps. That's according to Michelle Grossman, an authority on violent extremism, who works with the Australian Federal Police. She says forcing people to stay in poor conditions in camps puts them at greater risk of developing resentment against Australia and of greater radicalisation. The Law Council of Australia, the country's leading advocacy group for lawyers, says the law could be unconstitutional. It will take effect next month. Dutton has said repatriations would be decided case by case, particularly where young children were involved. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, diminishing life under hot water. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia. A Myanmar government delegation has met with representatives of hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslim refugees in Bangladesh to discuss creating conditions for their safe repatriation. Myanmar's permanent foreign secretary discussed preparations for the repatriation and agreed to more talks. You can visit VOA Asia Facebook to see more. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, about 60% of the world's coral reefs are under stress from rising temperatures. That's according to the nonprofit group Reef Resilience Network. VOA's Kevin Enix tells us new research shows just how devastating two heat waves were to coral in the Indian Ocean.
In 2015 and 2016, the southern hemisphere was hit by back-to-back heat waves caused by the El Niño weather pattern. That 1-2 punch of warm weather did significant damage to some sensitive coral reef systems off the Indian Ocean.
We lost up to 50% of our corals now 3 years ago, in 2016. This is mainly the branching corals, so we're talking about Acropora, for example.
Acropora corals are an important building block of reefs. Heat waves happen even without climate change, but coral reefs used to have years to recover. But Catherine Head from the Zoological Society of London says that with the new reality of climate change, heat waves come more often and are more intense.
So if these heat waves become more frequent, as they're predicted to do, then the reefs simply won't have a chance to recover.
Head was part of a research team that was recently in the Indian Ocean gauging the damage done by the consecutive heat waves.
The staghorn corals, for instance, which are known to be more weedy species, were highly impacted. So 86% of the staghorn corals were actually affected by these heat waves, whereas some of the more robust corals were less affected.
The concern is that losing corals means we lose a significant amount of the ocean's diversity.
So we will see a reduction in the diversity of the fish and the invertebrates which live on the reefs, and perhaps also a reduction in the structural complexity of the reef. So some corals contribute more to the calcium carbonate structure than others, and that's what causes this really complex, really interesting integral structure.
And despite efforts to revive dying reefs, coral reefs are slowly disappearing.
So there are predictions which say perhaps reefs may go functionally extinct by about 2050, should the emissions continue as they are at the moment. But really it depends how much we can reduce our carbon emissions as per the Paris Climate Change Agreement to keep sea surface temperatures below 2 degrees.
But right now, scientists say the world isn't doing what's necessary to prevent the devastating rise in sea temperatures. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia, new terror legislation to stop foreign fighters from returning to Australia has been approved. The government says the new laws will prevent carnage in Australia. Experts disagree, saying the exclusion measures will apply mostly to women and children, could increase the risk of radicalization. You'll find all the big stories on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, VOA's Faith Lapidus has been keeping tabs on scientists at IBM's Zurich-based research lab and the University of Zurich, where they've used a machine learning to analyze millions of cells from breast cancer tissue of 140 tumors, creating what they describe as an atlas of these tumors.
According to a 2018 World Health Organization report, breast cancer is the most common cancer among women, with approximately 2.1 million new cases each year. Joanna Wagner, a researcher at the University of Zurich, says it's a difficult disease to treat.
Cancer is composed of different components, and our motivation, our aim was to characterize these components in detail, because we know that if we know exactly how tumors are built, we might be able to better tailor therapies in a tumor-specific way.
She and her colleagues used a process called single-cell mass cytometry to examine 26 million cancer cells from 140 patients.
What we get in the end is for each cell a spectrum of which proteins are present on this cell and how much. And we can compare this across these 26 million cells that we measured. And this enables us to really get a very detailed idea of how cancer cells look, how they differ between patients, what's the difference between cancer tissue and non-cancer tissue.
To make sense of all that data, they worked with computer scientists who used machine learning to decode what they describe as a breast cancer ecosystem, in which different types of tumor cells were the main species. In research published recently in the journal Cell, they report that aggressive tumors are often dominated by a single type of tumor cell, which often displays high levels of abnormality. Previously, more aggressive tumors were thought to be more diverse. Researcher Mariana Rapsomaniki says this abnormality could be one reason why women respond differently to therapy and why some medications don't work.
These cells that are characterized by high abnormality are also characterized by high plasticity, and this is a characteristic that allows cells to better adapt to their environment and evade treatment.
By identifying the unique cellular composition of tumors, the atlas these researchers are compiling could provide a more detailed roadmap to new therapy designs for fighting cancer. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
A big, fierce dinosaur apparently has a little cousin, as VOA's Rick Pantaleo takes a moment to explain.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 1998, when Sterling Nesbitt was a 16-year-old high school junior, he took part in a dig expedition in New Mexico's Zuni Basin. During that dig, the budding young paleontologist found a unique and nearly complete skeletal fossil. Today, Nesbitt is now a paleontologist and an assistant professor at Virginia Tech. Nesbitt and his colleagues have recently determined that the fossil he had dug up over 20 years ago is actually an early and tiny relative of the mighty Tyrannosaurus rex. Scientists have determined that the dinosaur they name Susquehannas hazeleye stood nearly a meter high at its hips and was about 3 meters in length and weighed between 21 and 41 kilograms. Despite its diminutive size, Susquehannas hazeleye is said to have been much like its bigger cousin, a ferocious carnivore that ate a diet of small animals. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on many great radio stations around Asia, like DZUP 1602 AM Radio at the University of the Philippines in Diliman, Quezon City. We say hello and thanks to everyone there who's tuned in today. We'd also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zainab Abdel-Rahman, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. That's Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.